Well, maybe while we're waiting, just maybe a prefatory remark. So some of this paper was based on conversations I was having with my friend Howard Robinson. So Howard was a longtime substance dualist, but then he converted to Catholicism. And of course, the Catholic Church condemned substance dualism at the Council of Vienne in 1311, which made that position very uncomfortable for him. And so he was sort of looking for the next view, and he has moved in the direction of idealism, I'm very sad to say. But, you know, I'm always asking, why not hylomorphism? It offers a sort of way that you can, you know, reconcile these things. And he's very, very resistant to that. And so some of the terrain in this paper kind of maps out why it is that he's so resistant and trying to find exactly what his tacit assumptions are. And so at least the dualist, the conversation with the dualist that takes place in here is a conversation with Howard's subconscious commitments. Well, let me think. So the Council of Vienne was very concerned with, so there was a movement in Italy at the time that had to do with the philosopher Pierre Jean de Louvie. He was a Franciscan spiritualist. So what they were endorsing, gotta remember this. So they were endorsing a Catharist kind of view, which wanted to say that the world of material things was evil. So sort of Platonism gone rogue, gone Gnostic, gone extreme, which wanted to say that the material world was somehow evil or degenerate. And so the goal was to escape it. And, you know, so they wanted to abstain from any kind of material possessions and anything like this. And so part of the package was to claim that we were just these, you know, spiritual entities or whatever that were heading toward being disembodied and then we'd be somehow perfected or whatever. Is that right, sir? You know? And so and the Catholic Church said, well, no, because Christianity had a long history of condemning Gnostic sects of exactly that sort, because you have a lot of difficulty accommodating the notion of incarnation. You know, why would God become a human being, become part of this degenerate physical universe? Likewise, something can't become a degenerate image of itself. And, you know, if Christ is God embodied, then you don't get that. And then why would there be a resurrection story? Why would you come back into this stuff if the whole goal was to get out? So there are reasons why there's a long history of condemning those Gnostic ideas. And so these Franciscans were endorsing that kind of a Gnosticism combined with this substance dualism. And so the Council of Vienne said, no, that's completely inconsistent with central theses in the Christian tradition. So substance dualism becomes very uncomfortable. And would-be Catholic substance dualists have to work out some sort of accommodation, or as Howard did, become become idealist, or maybe, I don't know, hylomorphous or something. So there's a common story about the natural world. It's so common, in fact, that even philosophers who look to reject it remain tacitly committed to it in the kinds of questions they ask and the philosophical theories and arguments they take seriously. That story says the physical universe is a vast, undifferentiated sea of matter and energy that is or will be described exhaustively by our best physics. The vocabulary of physics, let's assume for simplicity, includes predicates and terms that enable us to describe objects, which I'll call physical materials, and their properties. These materials and properties are basic or fundamental in the sense that, according to the story, they compose any other physical thing that might exist, though they themselves remain uncomposed of anything more basic or fundamental. When it comes to describing these other non-fundamental things, we employ different vocabularies whose predicates and terms differ from those of physics. And so initially, one might have the impression that these vocabularies describe domains of objects and properties different from those which physics describes. Whether or not they do is something on which common storytellers differ. Some claim that the impression is false, although there are nuanced variations on this theme. The nihilist or eliminativist variation says that only the vocabulary of physics describes anything real, and that predicates and terms of the other non-fundamental vocabularies correspond to nothing. But theirs is a marginal variation of the story. The most common way of telling the common story is to say that non-fundamental vocabularies such as biology and psychology do in some sense correspond to reality. that they do so because they employ higher order predicates and terms. The term higher order is used in different ways. I use it here in the old Russell Whitehead way that was later adopted by Hilary Putnam. So roughly, higher order predicates and terms define operations on more basic things. We can introduce some higher order terms to describe the people in this room. We can say that a fronter is a person who satisfies one type of condition. He or she occupies a seat in the front of the room. And that a backer is a person who satisfies another type of condition. He or she occupies a seat in the back of the room. In any given speech act, the term fronter or backer is going to pick out a person on the list of people in the room if it picks out anything at all. In speaking this way, however, we don't add the list of people in the room, as if we'd have to worry about overcrowding by letting in the fronters and backers in addition to the people who are already here. By introducing these terms, we simply introduce a new way of talking about the existing inventory of people who are here. Among philosophers, the most common way of telling the common story, let's just call it physicalism for simplicity, says that the predicates and terms of non-fundamental vocabularies are analogous to the terms fronters and backers. In talking of plants, animals, people, money, love, success, exhilaration, and so on, we are merely talking about more fundamental things, perhaps the most fundamental things, using a different vocabulary. It's in this sense that physicalism licenses reduction. Now, the term reduction, used in many different ways, I use it here in a way that meshes with the reductionist tradition of philosophy of mind. So the core idea of reduction in this sense is descriptive and explanatory takeover. Theory B is able to take over the descriptive and explanatory jobs of theory A. Reduction in this sense concerns theories or conceptual frameworks, but it has a stiff ontological condition. Reduction is supposed to reveal that what we initially took to be two domains, one described by each theory, is in fact only one domain. Theory A and theory B provide two different vocabularies for describing the same things. Theory B, however, the reducing theory, is more basic or fundamental. Its predicates and terms provide more accurate or adequate descriptions and explanations than the vocabulary of theory A allows. The implication, then, is that theory B provides the real account of what the entities posited by theory A are and why those entities do what they do. Yet even though theories A and B, in some sense, pick out the same domain of objects and properties, the relations between the objects and properties described by reduced and reducing theories, respectively, are typically not straightforward identity relations. Because the vocabulary of theory A comprises higher order predicates and terms, the use of those predicates and terms will typically not correspond 1-1 to the predicates and terms of theory B. So we cannot say that all the objects and properties posited by theory A are identical to those posited by theory B. What is nevertheless the case is that the predicates and terms of theory A pick out only objects and properties that appear on the list of things posited by theory B, if they pick out anything at all. Consequently, theory A doesn't add anything to the inventory of objects and properties that exist beyond those posited by theory B. It simply provides a different way of talking about them. Speaking of atheoretic objects and properties is thus like speaking of fronters and backers. Pardon me. Unlike the case of fronters and backers, however, in real cases of reduction, we're typically not cognizant, at least not initially, of working with higher order predicates and terms. We instead simply find ourselves using two different vocabularies, and given the differences between them, we take these vocabularies to correspond to different domains. We nevertheless become convinced after studying the matter that, in fact, there is only one domain, that the predicates and terms of theory A simply pick out entities belonging to the domain of theory B, insofar as the latter entities satisfy various conditions. This marks a recognition that in principle, theory B can take over any of the descriptive and explanatory work performed by theory A, for the true description and explanation of what happens in domain A has everything to do with the objects and properties posited by theory B, at least insofar as we conceive of true descriptions and explanations as ones that correspond to what things there are. There is nevertheless a variation on this commonest version of the common story, which endorses a different conception of successful description and explanation. What I'll call a subjectivist view of description and explanation. The subjectivist insists that for reasons bound up with our natural and cultural histories, we often use language in descriptive and explanatory ways that have no essential connection to the goal of saying what there is and why it does what it does. We might, for instance, use a biological or a psychological vocabulary to describe basic states of matter and energy, not with the aim of describing and explaining those states in the maximally accurate way physics allows, but with the aim of satisfying interests of some other idiosyncratic sort. Daniel Dennett, for instance, has proposed that we employ a psychological vocabulary because it enables us to describe and explain things more efficiently, if less accurately, than physics. Whatever the details, on the subjectivist account, our interests can be satisfied only by using a vocabulary other than the vocabulary of physics. The success or adequacy of explanation in the subjectivist sense thus has nothing necessarily to do with what there is and why it does what it does. And that is what enables many physicalists to reconcile their commitment to physicalism with anti-reductionism, the claim that some non-fundamental vocabularies are not reducible to physics. Now, the term physicalism is also used in many different ways. I'm using it here to refer to the strong claim that everything could be exhaustively described and explained by physics. So elsewhere, I've argued that any adequate definition of physicalism has to imply the core physicalist thesis that everything is physical. Physicalism, in other words, must rule out the existence of non-physical things. By these lights, many definitions of physicalism are inadequate. The claims that all objects are composed of entities described by physics, or that all properties supervene on properties described by physics, fail to imply the core physicalist thesis because they're all compatible with the existence of non-physical properties. An object composed of physical entities might still have non-physical properties, and an object's non-physical properties might still supervene on or be necessitated by its physical properties. The challenge facing physicalists who want to embrace anti-reductionism is to reconcile the claim that everything can be exhaustively described and explained by physics with the claim that physics cannot take over all the descriptive and explanatory jobs that some non-fundamental vocabulary, such as biology or psychology, performs. Prima facie, if physics describes and explains everything without remainder, then there can be no descriptive and explanatory work left for any other vocabulary to perform. The sought-after reconciliation comes in the form of a subjectivist account of explanation. Non-fundamental vocabularies satisfy descriptive and explanatory interests different from any that can be satisfied by physics. Because physics cannot satisfy these interests, it cannot take over the descriptive and explanatory jobs that non-fundamental vocabularies perform, and because reduction involves descriptive and explanatory takeover, those non-fundamental vocabularies are not reducible to physics. Consequently, even if physics can describe and explain exhaustively what there is and why it does what it does, it might nevertheless fail to satisfy the idiosyncratic interests that motivate other forms of description and explanation, especially those that only non-fundamental vocabularies can satisfy. Biology, psychology, and other non-fundamental vocabularies can thus remain irreducible to physics on the subjectivist view, and for historical reasons which we needn't describe here, this has seemed attractive to many physicalists. It has enabled them to deny that reduction is an unavoidable implication of their view. Now, some people who have heard the common story as I've related it so far don't like it. They give a different version of it. Non-fundamental vocabularies, they say, don't comprise, or don't comprise solely, higher-order predicates and terms. Some, at least, are first-order predicates and terms that pick out objects and properties which are ontologically on a par with those described by physics, but nevertheless distinct from the objects and properties described by physics. Descriptions and explanations of what these things are and what they do resist reduction to physics, not because those descriptions and explanations satisfy idiosyncratic interests, but because those objects and properties are just as fundamental ontologically as those which physics describes. Persons in particular, they say, enjoy an agency and autonomy that just isn't countenanced by the versions of the common story I've related so far. The physicalist versions, which don't deny the existence of personal agency altogether, imply either that this agency is really just the agency of physical materials in disguise, or else a byproduct of our idiosyncratic ways of conceptualizing the agency of those materials. So these storytellers, these dissenters, let's just call them dualists, they want more. And because of that, they conclude that persons are not physical. Persons, they say, are not even composed of physical materials. To understand why dualists are inclined to conclude this, it's important to remember that they are still telling a version of the common story, and it's one of the story's basic premises that the physical universe, what it contains and why those things are what they do, can in principle be described and explained exhaustively by physics. If persons were composed of physical materials, the same would have to be true of them, say dualists. They would simply be collections of physical materials, and any agency we attributed to them would be at best the agency of physical materials in disguise or the byproduct of idiosyncratic conceptualizations. Now, third group, call them emergentists, balk at the dualist line of reasoning. They agree with dualists that persons enjoy an agency that physicalism doesn't accommodate, and that a subjectivist account of explanation doesn't help with that accommodation. But they disagree with dualists that the irreducibility of personal agency requires denying that persons are composed of physical materials. Persons, they say, are individuals distinct from any of the materials described by physics, and they have powers and engage in activities different from the powers and activities of those materials. In this sense, say emergentists, persons are just as fundamental as physical materials, yet in another sense they're not, for persons are composed of those materials and composite entities depend for their existence on the entities composing them. To emergentists, the dualist line of reasoning seems like a non sequitur. Persons are agents whose powers and activities are different from those of the physical materials composing them. How is it supposed to follow, as dualists purport, that their dependence on composing materials nullifies their agency or the distinctiveness of their powers and activities? By emergentist lights, the dualist assumes that if X depends compositionally on Y, then X depends on Y in every respect that bears on agency or autonomy. More precisely, if X is composed of the Ys, then X has no powers distinct from the powers of the Ys, and X engages in no activities distinct from the activities of the Ys. Only then might it follow that if persons are composed of material parts, then they cannot be agents whose powers and activities are distinct from those of their parts. But, emergentists want to know, why would anyone accept such a crude principle? There are at least two possible motivations for the dualist principle. One concerns composition, the other supervenience. So the former motivation derives from a view that takes composites to be higher order objects in the sense of higher order discussed earlier. A hylomorphic theory like Kit Fine's, for instance, takes a composite object to exist exactly if there are more fundamental objects satisfying a certain condition, or, in the limit case of standard mereology, any condition at all. Such views don't imply the dualist assumption directly, but they do make it easier to accept. They suggest that there is nothing to a composite other than the things composing it. Referring to one thing, the whole, simply introduces a new way of talking about many things. But as with talk of fronters and backers, introducing this way of talking doesn't add anything to the inventory of what exists, unless one accepts the further assumption that what exists can be a matter of mere stipulation, which I'll put to one side. If there is nothing to a whole other than its parts, then it's plausible to suppose that in speaking of the powers and activities of a whole, we can only be speaking of the powers and activities of its parts. Consequently, if dualists assume a view of composition along these lines, it's easy to appreciate why they might think that being composed of physical materials would undermine the agency of persons. Given such a view of composition, talk of persons, their powers and activities, is just a way of talking about the powers and activities of physical materials. Emergentists must therefore endorse a different view of composition. Composition cannot simply be a function of satisfying some higher order description, or if one wants to accept that there are different non-competing notions of composition, emergentists must insist that there is a composition operation different both from fusion and from Fine's principles of embodiment. Composition has to make an ontological difference. It has to add more than a name to the inventory of what exists. It has to add individuals with distinctive powers, powers, in other words, different from any of the powers of their material parts. So the motivation behind this idea combines the Eleatic principle, the claim that the only things that exist are ones that play some sort of causal role, with an anti-reductionist constraint, namely, the explanation for why an individual enters into at least some of the causal relations it does cannot be reduced to the operations of other things. If, for instance, the causal relations into which the table entered could be given an exhaustive account in terms of the physical materials composing it, then parsimony would dictate that, in fact, contrary to what we originally assumed, there is no table, but only a plurality of physical materials which we mistakenly took to compose an individual. Let us call individuals with powers different from any of the powers of their material parts emergent individuals. It should be evident that physicalists and dualists both deny that there are emergent individuals. According to physicalists, either there are no composite individuals at all, And to speak of composite individuals is to speak of nothing at all, or else to speak of composite individuals is to use higher order predicates and terms to speak of the more fundamental objects and properties described by physics. Dualists, for their part, claim that persons have powers distinct from any that might be described by physics. So, if they endorse the aforementioned dualist principle, they too must deny that persons are emergent individuals. For if they endorse the dualist principle, they must deny that persons are physical composites at all. Only then can the agency or autonomy they attribute to persons be preserved. Emergentists say that physicalists and dualists are both wrong. Physical materials can compose individuals distinct from the materials themselves. This distinctiveness is not merely verbal, moreover. It is not merely a matter of adding a new predicate or term to the inventory of predicates and terms employed by physics. A composite individual is instead an entity in its own right with powers distinct from any of those had by its composing materials. This implies a commitment to a composition operation different from thin composition operations like standard mereological fusion and Fine's principles of embodiment. One candidate for this operation is hylomorphic composition as understood by thinkers like Aristotle. So hylomorphic theories say that individuals are composed of materials with a form, or structure, organization, call it what you like. The concepts of matter and form are primitives within a hylomorphic framework. It's not possible to define them in terms of any categories that are more basic. The only way of defining them is to specify the roles that they play within the theory and to illustrate how the theory as a whole applies to the paradigmatic cases it's supposed to explain. Aristotle uses his hylomorphic framework to perform a variety of theoretical tasks, initially the task of accounting for change or coming to be in the face of Eleatic arguments such as the one discussed in the physics. So here's, in a nutshell what the argument says. If something comes to be, then either it comes to be from what is or it comes to be from what is not. Now, nothing comes to be from what is, for it already is, and so it cannot come to be. And nothing comes to be from what is not, for nothing can come from nothing. Therefore, nothing comes to be. Now, Aristotle thinks hylomorphism provides resource for diagnosing what's wrong with arguments of this sort. Whenever there's a change, he says, there's always two explanatory factors at work. First, there's something that exists prior to the change and persists through it. Second, that persisting thing takes on a characteristic or form which it previously lacked, or depending on the case, it loses a form which it previously had. To say that Socrates becomes musical at T implies that Socrates exists prior to T, that he lacked the form of being musical, but took on that form at T. A persisting thing coming to have different forms at different times is thus what change consists in. What's wrong with Eleatic arguments, says Aristotle, is that they equivocate on the expressions what is and what is not. Premise three is true if what is not designates what doesn't exist at all. Nothing can come from nothing at all. But it's false if what is not designates what is not F for some characteristic F. Socrates can clearly come to be musical from having been from not having been musical. Likewise, premise two is true if what is designates what is already F. We cannot say that Socrates became musical at T if he was already musical at T. But it is false if what is designates simply what exists in some way, for Socrates himself existed prior to becoming musical, and he persists through his becoming musical. Consequently, we see either that the premises of the argument are true, but it commits a fallacy of equivocation, or else that the form of the argument is valid, but one of the premises is false. Now, Aristotle extended this way of understanding the coming to be of properties to account for the coming to be of substances. Their coming to be is more problematic on Aristotle's view, for according to him, substances are the fundamental bearers of properties and the fundamental subjects of change. It thus becomes unclear what persisting subject there could be to take on contrary forms in the case of a substance coming to be. Aristotle nevertheless insists that the pattern that we find in the case of properties, we also find in the case of substances. There is something that exists prior to a substance coming to be and that persists through its coming to be. A statue comes to be from some pre-existing stuff on account of that stuff changing its shape. A house comes to be on account of assembling some pre-existing materials housewise. And the same goes mutatis mutandis for natural things such as Socrates, which are substances in the strictest sense. Now, the first of the principles that Aristotle appeals to in accounting for change, the persisting subject of the change, is the matter of the change. The second principle, the characteristic that the matter takes on, is the form. So the terms matter and form are defined in relation to each other in a hylomorphic framework. Matter is always matter for a particular kind of change. That is, it's always matter for the coming to be of a particular kind of form. Not just anything can operate as the matter for just any form. Not just anything can take on the form that makes something a house or a human. A given matter is instead suited to a given range of forms on account of having the potentiality or power to take on those forms. Now, the powers of natural things were of particular interest to Aristotle. By his reckoning, natural things include plants and animals, their parts, and the simple bodies, earth, air, fire, and water, his fundamental physical materials. What qualifies these as natural is that each has within itself a source of change and stability. Unlike the case of an artifact such as a table, which comes to have its characteristic shape on account of an external agent, a human develops its distinctive array of parts and carries on its distinctive metabolic processes and other activities, not on account of an external agent, but on account of itself. It is itself the source of the distinctively human characteristics that it takes on. Natural things are the ultimate engines of change in Aristotle's view. They're the things that are ultimately responsible for why anything undergoes the changes it does. Tracing the provenance of any putative change will eventually yield an explanation that has as its truth maker a natural substance or substances acquiring or losing some form or forms. Now, some things undergo stereotypical patterns of change. Biological development is the paradigm. Fish grow gills and scales, not lungs and skin, whereas humans do the opposite. These occurrences cannot happen by chance, Aristotle argues, for things that happen by chance do not display the kind of regularity we find in cases like biological development. Developmental changes happen instead on account of the natures of things. Behavioral regularities, whether in living things or in non-living materials, are due to the natures that things have. The changes that are due to something's nature are those which it undergoes on account of itself, that is, on account of just being the kind of thing it is. Now, a thing's nature comprises both its matter and its form. To put it in the terms I've used so far, matter and form both make a difference to what something is and what something does, what it can do, the powers that it has. A human being will fall downward on account of its matter, for the latter includes a large portion of the element earth. Because it's in the nature of earth to move downward on Aristotle's view, it's in the nature of anything composed of a sufficiently large quantity of earth to move downward as well. Likewise, it's in the nature of fire to move upward on Aristotle's view. Because of this upward moving nature, a human is able to grow and maintain itself. If Socrates were composed of earth alone, he would collapse in a heap of earthy rubble. Fire counteracts this tendency, but the presence of fire is not the only thing needed to explain human growth and homeostasis. Left to their own devices, earth and fire would separate themselves. They would separate themselves from each other completely, with the result that living things like Socrates would be torn apart. The fiery materials composing them would ascend skyward, while their earthy materials would accumulate on the ground in a heap. Something prevents this from happening. Something in a living whole proportions, regulates, and constrains the activities of the materials composing it and ensures that the whole itself remains a unified, persisting individual. That something is form, or dynamic structure, organization, again, call it whatever you want. Form explains what unifies diverse materials into a single whole. There is no unified composite individual apart from a form. Destroying something's form results in a disunified heap. The remains of a human, what are often referred to very confusedly from an Aristotelian perspective, using singular terms like human body or corpse, do not compose a single individual at all. They are instead materials that used to compose an individual, but that no longer do. Form also explains diachronic unity or persistence, why a living whole such as Socrates can exist one and the same over time, even though the materials composing him are in constant flux. Socrates persists so long as his form does. Likewise, the biological processes in which Socrates engages are directed toward developing and maintaining a mature, properly functioning member of the humankind. What unifies various stages of the developmental process, as well as various metabolic processes themselves, is their directedness toward this end. Now, based on this brief overview of Aristotle's hylomorphism, it's possible to identify the theoretical roles that hylomorphic form is supposed to play, the ones that implicitly define the notion of form. These roles supply and give us this implicit definition of a form. So, first of all, form is what accounts for change or generation, especially the generation of composite wholes. Form is what accounts for the unity of composite wholes. Form is what accounts for a composite whole's persistence over time, especially in cases in which it changes its matter over time. Form is what accounts for kind membership, especially membership in natural kinds. And form is what accounts for behavioral regularities, especially the self-maintaining and developmental processes in which living things engage. If form is understood in this way, then hylomorphism is compatible with both physicalism and dualism, as I've described them. So a physicalist can claim that a hylomorphic account of composition is correct, but deny that there are any composite individuals, or insist that the only composite individuals can be described exhaustively by physics. Conversely, a dualist can endorse the same claims and simply add that persons are non-physical, mereological simples. What I'm interested in considering, however, is how hylomorphism provides emergentists with the notion of composition they need to sustain their commitment to emergent individuals. Now, hylomorphism has long been sidelined in serious philosophical discussions due to a widespread perception that it's unscientific, that the scientific revolution proved that the notion of form is empty, that it has no real-world application. Marjorie Green nevertheless noticed a similarity between Aristotle's form and the notion of organization at home in modern biology. So, quote, eidos, form, functions in a number of striking respects in the same way as the concept of organization in modern biology. The eidos of an entity or process is its organizing principle, the way it works to organize some substrate. Form in nature exists in and only in that which it informs as the organizing principle in an appropriate matter. Eidos in the sense of organizing principle is a definitive concept for biological method, though its modern counterpart is couched in different terms. Quote. Elsewhere, I've elaborated Green's idea and defended a hylomorphic theory that takes the ontological commitments of biology seriously. That theory is based on an ontology of individuals and powers, and I've argued that forms are best understood as activities of a special sort, in particular, activities in which individuals are essentially and continuously engaged. Emergent individuals are essentially and continuously engaged in organizing or configuring the materials that compose them. I'm busy configuring the materials that compose me. You are busy configuring the materials that compose you. These are numerically distinct yet closely resembling events. Though our respective ongoing configuring activities explain our unity and persistence through the dynamic influx and efflux of matter and energy that characterize our interactions with the surrounding world. Now, contrary to what the noun form might suggest, form on this view is not a thing. It's not some further individual or agent distinct from what has it. If form were such a thing, it's difficult to see how it could play the unifying role that form is supposed to play. So Aristotle, Mark Johnston, some other people have rehearsed an argument that brings this idea out. So very roughly, suppose that F is my form, which is, on this view, an entity distinct from me. This entity is supposed to be responsible for unifying physical materials into a single composite whole. But it seems plausible to suppose that something must also unify that further thing with me. If that unifier is some yet further entity, then a regress commences, for then we have to know what unifies that yet further entity with me and the original other entity. If, on the other hand, the unifier is just that other entity F itself, then positing that seems ontologically extravagant, for in that case, nothing prevents us from saying that I myself am the unifier. If the unifying role can be played by F itself, there doesn't seem to be a principled reason why it cannot be played by I myself, albeit by a special activity in which I engage. Now, that activity is not identical to me. It's a property of me and hence differs from me just as the apple's redness differs from the apple. Since it's my activity, the foregoing problem explaining its unity with me does not arise. It seems plausible to conclude then that form, or to put it more clearly, forming, is something that a composite individual does. There's not some entity other than me that is responsible for unifying the materials that compose me. Doing this simply belongs to my nature, to use Aristotle's term. It's one of the things I do simply on account of being the kind of thing I am. But my nature comprises more. The materials composing me belong to my nature as well. They're responsible for many of the changes I undergo, in general, changes that do not depend on my forming activity, and that the methods of physics try to examine by arduously isolating materials from the multiplicity of ways that they can be configured in the natural world. So on this view, that's what physics does. Physics aims at trying to get at what basic materials there are independent of their inclusion in any sort of structured whole. And it's very hard to do that because on this view, most of the things that we encounter in the natural world belong to structured wholes of one sort or other. How exactly are the material and formal factors of my nature related? It seems prima facie plausible to suppose that the powers and activities of emergent individuals are constrained in some ways by the physical materials composing them, that the powers and activities of persons cannot vary in any way whatsoever with respect to the powers and activities of those materials. This is part of what it means to, for material conditions to make a difference to what emergent individuals can do, part of what it means for material conditions to belong to their natures. The hylomorphic view I've defended claims that the distinctive powers of emergent individuals are essentially embodied in the parts that they have. To understand what this means, we first have to consider the activities of emergent individuals. Those activities are not random physical occurrences. An activity is rather an event that is composed of other events with a certain coordination or form. That form, we could just call it an activity-making form, unifies diverse events into a single whole in something analogous to the way that forms discussed so far unify diverse physical materials into a single whole. Let me say more about this. Emergent individuals are composed of parts. Those parts have powers of their own. A human's muscles have the power to contract, its neurons have the power to fire, and so on. When we walk, talk, dance, and engage in the various other activities we do, we impose an order on the way our parts manifest their powers. My parts needn't manifest their powers in an ordered way. It's possible for my neurons to fire, my muscles to contract in ways that do not compose an activity of, say, throwing a baseball. Fatigue, injury, insufficient training, and many other factors can result in my parts manifesting their powers in uncoordinated ways that fail to compose an activity at all. But when I succeed in throwing, I succeed in imposing an order or form on the way my parts, and in many cases surrounding things such as the baseball, manifest their powers. I order their manifestations throwing-wise. In some cases, the ordering is conscious and intentional, as in throwing a baseball, but in many cases, the ordering is neither conscious nor intentional, as in digesting food or increasing blood flow to the legs in response to something fearful. In whatever way it occurs, whether consciously and intentionally or not, the result of this ordering is an activity. Activities, then, are composed of the manifestations of the powers of an emergent individual's parts, and in some cases, manifestations of the powers of surrounding things as well. Those parts embody the emergent individual's power in the sense that it's the operation of those parts, coordinated in the right way, that composes the emergent individual's activities. Your circulatory system embodies your power to bring oxygenated blood to various parts of yourself in the sense that when your heart, arteries, veins, and so on manifest their powers in the right coordinated way, those manifestations compose the activity of bringing oxygenated blood to various parts of yourself. Similarly, my visual system embodies my power to see in the sense that my retinas, optic nerves, lateral geniculate bodies, and so on manifest their powers in the right coordinated way with objects in the environment. When that happens, those manifestations compose my activity of seeing. Now, the hylomorphic theory I've defended claims that all the powers of emergent individuals are essentially embodied in their parts. The activities in which they engage are essentially composed of the coordinated manifestations of the powers of their parts and surrounding things. It's impossible, not just nomologically, but metaphysically, for me to engage in the activity of, say, throwing a baseball, unless my parts manifest their powers in the right coordinated way. Likewise, it's impossible, not just nomologically, but metaphysically, for Gabriel to think, feel, perceive, or act unless his parts manifest their powers in the right coordinated way. Essential embodiment of emergent powers and activities is the default position for hylomorphists, and it operated this way even for Aristotle, who famously or notoriously denied it for the case of thought. But here's what he says about these things in general. Quote, in fact, the affections of soul all seem to be with a body. Excitement, calmness, fear, pity, courage, also joy, and both loving and hating. For whenever we have them, the body is in some way affected. If this is the case, then clearly the affections are enmattered forms, or my preferred term, embodied forms. Hence, their definitions will be, for instance, quote, anger is a certain movement of such and such a body or a part or power of it by this for the sake of that. the affections of soul are inseparable from the natural matter of animals, end quote. That's his default position. He thinks that there are good reasons why thought or understanding doesn't fit into this, but the argument, I think, is flawed for reasons that are very well rehearsed in the literature on the passage. Okay, but in what ways does the essential embodiment of emergent powers place constraints on what emergent individuals can do? Given reasonable assumptions, essential physical embodiment implies robust supervenience and necessitation theses. The most robust among them claims that material twins must be formal twins. For any possible worlds, W1 and W2, and physical materials, the X's in W1, the Y's in W2. If the X's are exactly similar to the Y's in respect of the kinds of properties and relations that can be exhaustively described by physics, then the X's compose an individual Z, if and only if the Y's compose an individual whose form is exactly similar to Z's. It's not possible, in other words, for there to be physical materials that are exactly similar in all physical respects to the ones composing me, say, that do not compose an individual exactly like me in its powers and activities. Those materials could not compose an individual of another kind. There are no form inverts. Nor could those materials fail to compose any individual at all. There are no form zombies. The commitment to essential physical embodiment and the attendant notions of supervenience and necessitation should make it clear in what sense material conditions make a difference to the powers and activities of emergent individuals. But dualists might worry that these claims undermine the distinctive agency of emergent individuals. This worry provides a second possible motivation for the dualist principle mentioned earlier. If the powers and activities of emergent individuals cannot vary relative to the states of physical materials in a more freewheeling way than essential embodiment allows, then, dualists might say, the autonomy that emergent individuals are supposed to have is undermined. But how exactly is the dualist conclusion supposed to follow? Persons are individuals distinct from the materials composing them. They have powers that physical materials are not even candidates to have, and they engage in activities that physical materials are not even candidates to engage in. In what sense does the ball player fail to throw the baseball simply because he cannot engage in that activity unless his parts are disposed and operated in the right kind of way? Even if his powers are essentially embodied in the physiological mechanisms that compose him, it is not possible to reduce explanations of his powers and activities to descriptions of those mechanisms for reasons I've already rehearsed. There's more to the activities than the operations of those mechanisms. There's also the way those operations are ordered. Order, or form in general, is something different from things that get ordered. And in this case, it is something that only he can impose on the way his parts manifest their powers. One thing that might motivate the dualist worry is the idea that supervenience and or necessitation implies some type of explanatory condition, that if my powers and activities co-vary in all possible worlds with certain physical states, then those physical states explain my powers and activities in a way that undermines my agency, that, for instance, I throw the baseball because of those physical states. There are two things to say here. First, supervenience and necessitation theses imply no explanatory conditions whatsoever. Consider necessitation the stronger of the theses. Generic necessitation thesis says, it's on the handout, necessarily for any X, if X has an A property F, then there's a B property G such that X has G, and necessarily for any Z, if Z has G, then Z has F. Okay. What this definition does not say is that Z's having G explains its having F, or that X has F because it has G. Necessitation entails nothing about explanation, and the same is true perforce of supervenience, which follows from necessitation given reasonable assumptions. Critics who assume that supervenience or necessitation entails some type of explanatory condition are just wrong as a matter of plain logic. This is one of the, I think, best established results in philosophy of mind. I mean, it was, late 80s. It was very clear, but people still walk around with this implicit assumption that supervenience and necessitation imply something explanatory. Okay, second, from a hylomorphic standpoint, claiming that physical states are by themselves sufficient to explain the powers and activities of emergent individuals is tantamount to denying that form belongs to the natures of those individuals. Since form is an aspect of my nature on that view, knowing only that my parts and surrounding materials are manifesting their powers still does not explain why I'm throwing a baseball. For that activity requires that my parts and surrounding materials manifest their powers throwing a baseball wise, and that is a form that only I can impose on them, a power that the physical materials composing me do not by themselves have, and hence that cannot be explained by appeal to those materials alone. So the worry that supervenience and necessitation relations might undermine the agency of emergent individuals freights in assumptions that are foreign to hylomorphism. Taking this worry and the related worry about composition seriously is tantamount to rejecting the view. It is, in fact, a way of sticking to the story, the common story about the natural world with which I began. That story accords hegemonic range and power to the explanatory resources of physics. Whether this range and power is attractive, as physicalists find it, or repulsive, as dualists do, the differences between these common storytellers are less important than their common tendency to adhere to this central element of the common story. A tendency to embrace the problems that go along with it, and to ignore the possibility that the common story might be merely that, a story, and that a different metaphysical framework might provide for a more accurate account of what persons are. According to hylomorphists, form is a basic ingredient of the universe. That universe is not the homogeneous sea of matter and energy that common storytellers take it to be. It is instead a landscape punctuated with pockets of organized change and stability, composite individuals, paradigmatically living things, with structures that confer on them powers that distinguish what they can do from what unstructured materials can. The resulting picture enables emergentists to reject the dualist principle and the worries motivating it, while at the same time accepting that the powers and activities of emergent individuals are constrained in some ways by the physical materials composing them. Hylomorphic emergentists can accept that the activities and powers of persons cannot vary in any way whatsoever with respect to the activities and powers of the materials composing them. They can accept, in other words, Aristotle's idea that the nature of composite wholes comprises matter, that material conditions make a difference to what emergent individuals are doing and what they can do. This difference, however, does not undermine the agency of emergent individuals, because only those individuals are able to impose the forms that make actions what they are. Their natures and the natures of their actions comprise not just matter, in other words, but also form. An Aristotelian view of this sort marks a departure from the common story told by physicalists and dualists alike. It offers a promising way around many of the philosophical problems they have faced, and a powerful and intuitive framework for conceiving the nature of emergence and the purport of emergentism. Thank you.